Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your Chantress of Everything Valuable and Beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And, you know, I saw at Community Arts Workshop this beautiful image, and I looked into it, and the artist is a name that I thought I knew, Joe Rode. And I called them up. I said, you know, can you put me in touch with Joe? I want to talk to him on the radio program. I want to, you know, talk about the show that he's doing at Community Arts Workshop. But I also want to talk to him because he was in my master's thesis. And so we'll get into why. But I want to introduce Joe to the program. And I don't know why we haven't met before, but I'm so thrilled to have him on the air. He's a creative executive with 40 years at Walt Disney Imagineering, the overall creative and executive and supervising designer for Disney's Animal Kingdom theme park, including later expansions such as Expedition Everest, Legend of the Forbidden Mountain, Pandora, the World of Avatar. Other notable projects, the Adventures Club, I want to talk about that. Pleasure Island at Walt Disney World, a Disney resort and spa in Hawaii where he grew up, and it goes on and on and on. And what's so interesting to me is his work in animal conservation and how he got into that. Of course, it was via the Animal Kingdom theme park, but he's used his art to raise funds nationally, internationally in conservation. And he received in 2022 the Disney Conservation Fund's first Conservation Legacy Award. And he's also a Disney legend. And I found two, last night I was researching him as in general, found two blogs where they were rejoicing in the fact that Joe actually had walked into the building in Glendale, and they had pictures of Joe in the building in Glendale saying, "What's happening? This is a fantastic move. We can't wait to see what's next." And I want to talk about that too. But there's a quote, Tom Bricky is a journalist who writes about creative endeavors such as Joe's life's work. And he writes, "Rode's ability to world build and thoughtfully integrate intellectual property is incredible." And I wanted to talk about that. And Joe is with us today to talk about those sorts of things. And then another quote that I found, Joe, is about a book that you co-authored or had, I think you wrote the frontispiece or the prologue. But anyway, the book says, "This is Joe's work is a master's degree in psychology of the themed experience." Okay, so here's Joe, and we're going to talk about everything. Oh, the book is called Theme Park Design and the Art of the Themed Entertainment, published in 2016 with David Younger. And we'll talk a little bit about the books and the career, et cetera. Passionate argument for coexistence of conservation and communities and a recognition of the essential role that ecosystems play in our existence. And now we are so faced with that in our world, so faced. I mean, we've got Altadena, we've got Palisades and beyond, so faced with that integration, and it's a challenge. Can we start with something, Joe, that was fascinating to me, the Explorers Club, your expedition to Western Mongolia to raise money for snow leopard conservation efforts. I want to start with that trip.
Sure. Thank you, Elizabeth. So that came up some years ago because of the work I had done for Disney's Animal Kingdom. I believe it was because of that work. I was approached by a couple members of the Explorers Club, which is a real, it's just what it sounds like. It is a club in New York City founded about 120 years ago by a bunch of, at that time, Arctic explorers. And it's grown over the years to include most of the famous biologists, astronauts, et cetera, that you might know or have heard of. And I was invited to become a member. I was kind of surprised because I, like many people in the Explorers Club, a little bit of imposter syndrome of like, wow, I can't believe I'm in this club with these other people. So anyway, I got into the club and immediately thought to myself, I can't really, even though I'm in this club because of what I've done, it seems like I have to do something more specific here. And I'd always wanted to go to Mongolia, but I don't really like to go places casually. And so I poked around my network of wildlife conservation people to see if I could find someone with a connection to Mongolia who needed support. And that ended up being Rodney Jackson. He's a very prominent snow leopard researcher. And so collaborating with him, we identified a project area, and I put together an expedition to go to Mongolia for a month and to travel through the far western part of Mongolia, which is kind of mountainous, looks a bit like the American West, and to do paintings, and that these paintings, large paintings, the whole point of them was they were so big that you couldn't believe you could do them. So they were like 5 feet across and, you know, 4 feet high, like that, of snow leopard habitat, the place where the snow leopard lived. And the reason for this is a lot of people don't understand the relationship between animals and land and animals, and how they're tied together. So I thought, I don't need to do a bunch of pictures of snow leopards. The snow leopard is the land itself. The land is the leopard. The leopard is the land. I'm going to go do these images of the land. Come back. We will sell them and we will raise money for the Snow Leopard Conservancy. It ended up being a documentary film that traveled through festivals for a while. And it did indeed generate a lot of money for snow leopard conservation. But it was really interesting. I've always been interested in trying to explore this thing of what is it that you can do that is something you already do in a way, right? Everybody thinks they need to transform magically into Jane Goodall and go, you know, live in the forest or something. But in fact, everybody does something and they can do something that they do on behalf of the world, the planet, or other people. So that's what that expedition ended up being. It was quite an adventure. We're on horseback for most of a month.
So I question for you. You said you had never been to Mongolia before, but I discovered that you had done a sketch on one of the websites that kind of was celebrating you as a person and a creative, that yeah. You had done a sketch before that you had been in that environment. You remember?
Well, this is probably a sketch. So the trip to Mongolia was 2013. Yes. I've been going back and forth to the Himalayas since the 1980s for a very long time.
Okay.
And that's a broader cultural region. And so, you know, I have a lot of familiarity sort of culturally with the background cultures of this area. And of course I study, I'm a kind of an obsessive studier of things. I don't like to go places before I know something about them, so I don't step on someone's toes when I'm there. So I kind of did a lot of that. And so if you look through various fundraising things I've done over the years, I'll often go back and harvest sketches or paintings that I've done in some other context and use those as prints on behalf of, for example, the Community Arts Workshop here, some wildlife conservation things elsewhere, recently to raise funds for another upcoming expedition to go back to Nepal.
This is exactly what I was referring to. So there was a quote, and I have, it's from you somewhere. Maybe it's an Instagram account where you say, last year, I'll be back in later this year. I'll be back in Nepal, collaborating with partners in the Explorers Club on a snow leopard. And I made the connection that maybe that was the same expedition. Last time I was in Nepal was 5 days before the massive earthquake that destroyed many of the monuments in older parts of the cities in the central Himalayas. This view, and then there was a beautiful illustration, was sketched in Pathan Durban Square right about the time the earthquake hit in 2015. And so that's what I was referring to. I was making a connection that maybe that their expedition took you through Nepal. So I want to just quickly tell you why you were quoted in my master's thesis. I had an undergraduate degree from Tufts in Boston, and then was a single mom for years and years and didn't get a chance to go back and study and had like started a master's, but, you know, kids got in the way and all this. So in later life, I went back to USC and began a master's in what I started to call my undergraduate degree was in architectural history. And so I was always interested in the built environment that was a narrative structure, and that the built environment itself was a first source material, then read like a book. And so that was the idea that I came to, you know, as a very mature student to USC and said, I want to write a master's thesis about unreal history told through the environment. And so I studied theme parks, notably Williamsburg at the time. And this was 2000. This was, you know, 20 years ago, something like that. So I studied Williamsburg and I studied the New Jerusalem, which was a theme park that had to do with biblical history. And I studied it like all good master's art historians. I was, you know, encouraged to study the biases in the built environment, what the biases say. And of course, I grew up in Chicago. So I grew up going down to the dollhouse images that were in the basement of the museum. So they were, you know, the history of decorative arts told through dollhouse settings. Yeah, I'm sure you're familiar with those.
Is this at the Field?
Yes. And yeah, it was founded and built by a certain woman, and I forget her name now, but that was my introduction when I was, you know, 10 years old. I was fascinated by how, you know, this changed like Winterthur, you know, the museum Mr. DuPont set up. It changed room by room. And that sequential history of the decorative arts fascinated me, and I wanted to study that. And so I went and studied at Winterthur as well, Mr. DuPont's museum, where he told his slice of history through the decorative arts and the built environment. And so your work got into my master's thesis because of the narrative as a design tool. And that this was a sense of the idea of placemaking, but in aid of a certain message one wanted to convey. And so when I saw you about to, you know, do a show at Community Arts Workshop, I thought, where do I know that name from? And looked into my own master's thesis. Well, since that, I went on and studied material culture and have a doctorate now. And so this idea of material that is culture is so, you know, and I'm an appraiser. I mean, you know, it's so formative to how I think. So everything that you've done, it was just such a fun couple of hours last night looking at your, you know, various projects and career, you know, having 30 years at Imagineering and a respected veteran in the themed entertainment industry, leading all sorts of conceptual and design work. And then a cool thing that I want to talk about is you're a storyteller. And you describe yourself as a sometime media personality and a lecturer on creativity in corporate environments. I want to know the carryover. I think I know what you're going to say, having studied the built environment as a tool, a messaging tool. But I want to hear from you. When you talk about, when you're lecturing important CEOs, I want to just mention here, there was a resting moment in our new president's inauguration where there was all these leaders of massive organizations sitting behind Trump. And I looked at them and I thought to myself, there's a classical word for the type. So if you study typology, it's puer eternus, eternally boy.
Interesting.
And I looked at them and I thought, you know, that. And then I remembered that you had talked about someone had quoted you as a master's, your work is a master's degree in the psychology of the themed experience. And I thought, okay, there's my Jungian moment right there. And I want to ask Joe about how he lectures big shots like that.
Interesting question. Now, for most of my career, of course, this happened inside the context of the Disney company. So you're dealing with corporate people who are interested in the subject. You know,
are not interested.
They are typically an easier audience than you might find in a random sampling of corporate leaders, because they're there. A lot of these people could have other careers if they wanted to, and they've chosen to be here. But the key thing, I believe, is the material aspects of these kinds of jobs are relatively easy to define. They are businesses, there's operational standards, there's obviously legal standards, there's construction standards. So at a certain level of discussion, we all know what we're going to do. We're going to build a big thing out of concrete, steel, and plastics, and a bunch of people are going to come and utilize it, and somehow this will make somebody money. So that can't be what we're here to talk about, because it's a constant. It's like a null set, right? It's
yeah.
always gonna happen. What are we talking about then? We must be talking about what this is about. So very typically, I would open a meeting with a thematic premise. And I would really try to make clear to everyone involved, this includes the design team, the executive team, anyone who's going to discuss the project. Let's start by discussing, what is this even about? And how would we know that it was about that through any evidence of material encounter that we might have? And therefore, the project is going to take a shape something like this. And this helps people to corral the area of discussion so that you don't end up with just this kind of chaotic, every possible direction discussion. You are almost instantaneously discussing the validity of the theory that this particular physical thing you say you're going to do will successfully convey this idea. So it's a much more structured kind of conversation. Also, since you are interested in this kind of semiotic thing, it instantly implies structure. This person who is in the room with me works according to some kind of structure. Even though they are a creative person, they also seem to me, by the way they are speaking, forget about what came out of their mouth, the way they're talking is very structural.
Yeah.
Or I feel comfortable in this conversation with this person. We can talk about structure. We can talk about something we can all talk about. And so that's part of just a social way of involving people. I mean, there's no way to disinvolve these people. They are involved. Everyone is involved. I'm very, very, very interested in the collaborative nature of large-scale creative enterprises. I am a painter, of course. I mean, you came across me because of that art show. So that's a painter, right? But a painter works alone and is responding to an internal set of prompts of things that motivate them and things they want to express. as soon as you turn that into a big ensemble of 40 people, 100 people, 700 people, thousands, all that has to be externalized. It has to be spoken out loud, and it has to be understood by all parties so that you can get sort of free, autonomous, voluntary contribution rather than a command chain where you're telling everybody exactly what to do all the time. It's exhausting. It's not fun for people. It doesn't yield the best product. So what you're trying to do is externalize what normally is an internal creative process so that it can be shared by large numbers of people, and so that their motive for doing what they want to do is shared in common with all other people on the project. Does that make sense?
Okay. So what I'm gathering from that is, and this was a question that I wrote down last night that I wanted to ask you, how much of your psyche is involved in systems engineering versus the artistic process, or are they one and the same? Question one. Question two, what you're describing is a very top-down, here we are with the powers that be, and we're trying to form cohesiveness around a creative project. But what I want to hear is, okay, so this is my background, Joe, and why I'm so interested in hearing from you. So I quoted you in my master's thesis 20 some odd years ago, because my thesis it started out with the title Unreal History. And I was talking about, the Levittowns of the world in a way. And the fact that I saw these gated communities, 25 years ago, I saw these gated communities being unreal in a way, so that the setting, the architecture became unreal. And then I remember studying Disney's first projects in the built environment. I don't know if this even matters, but I remember this, Joe, and he took regular scale architecture as, we're all used to a certain height of door frames, a certain height of stairs and all the codes and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And he took that built-in, I think it was for the California experience maybe, but he took the regular standards of the built environment and just changed them ever so much, making it that it's almost a dreamscape because you're used to something, but you're not. And so the talent involved in that, is kind of this, it becomes a way of disembodying reality so that you can fit into a new reality. And that new reality is what someone has prepared for you to experience.
Yeah, I mean, it is a form of theater. When it's theater, we understand. Yeah. Very clearly, because it's so formalized. We go to a particular place, we sit somewhere, and we are allowed to entertain the idea of an imaginary circumstance. It's very clear. These kinds of spaces are a little different because they at first appear to be architecture.
Right.
Right? But they're actually theater. So the difference is, there are differences, and they're important to understand. One of the differences is you don't have the same control over what I'm going to call the cone of vision. People are moving through the environment as they please, more or less, right? And so rather than producing a kind of linear form of storytelling, this is where it comes back around to this discussion of thematic integrity. What you have to do is imbue the entirety of the space with both an emotional tone and some idea, so that it kind of doesn't matter where people look. They're going to come away with impressions because the place is entirely imbued with these impressions. So what you're referring to is the forced perspective, what we call forced perspective, in, for example, the construction of Main Street at Disneyland. So Main Street at Disneyland is not a documentary representation of a Main Street from 125 years ago. It's actually much more like the representation of a memory of a Main Street in the mind of a person who once lived it as a child, because it opened.
Okay, so here's Joe. This is why I wanted to talk with you about this, because in the mind of a person, so it's a very individualized concept of Main Street that may have, I mean, you can't get, what my question would be is, what would be, all right, okay. So let me also give you another example. So when I was working on you, including you and my master's thesis, I had a professor who took us to a museum that was doing, it was a farce, but it was a very forceful farce. It was doing an exhibition on Adolf Hitler's life. And Adolf Hitler's life was portrayed in the exhibit in a visual way of being a beautiful, positive childhood that grew up to a man who was misunderstood. And you left the exhibit with the feeling that, wow, maybe history had Hitler wrong. Maybe he was a misunderstood child. And it wasn't actually out there. It wasn't stated that way. It was shown that way. And so the professor was very wise in saying, you see how the visual presentation of a narrative can influence without words.
Yes, this is exactly right. I think it is a form of, there are many reasons for this, right? Part of it is you want, these places are more not, well, I'm going to say ambiguous. But many people, when they use the word ambiguous, it's misused to mean unclear. That's not what ambiguous means. Ambiguous is like ambidextrous. It means it means many things simultaneously. That is what it is, right? So because of that, because it's mounted with several ideas, multiple different kinds of people can move through the space and read the space according to their perception. And as you go generationally, it kind of will shift in its reading, because it isn't literal, literally meaning words, right? It isn't. It is composition. It is art. And so for us, when we were working for all those years, we just had a few, just Animal Kingdom, a few perceptions that we wanted people to come away with. I don't know if you've ever been to Animal Kingdom. It is peculiar in its photorealism. So if you follow the logic tree, you start with, okay, if the company wants to do a venue that is based on live animals, it follows then that this venue is going to have to promote the well-being and the involvement and the lives of such animals. It's going to have to be that way. So you cannot install these animals into an environment that is based on the aesthetics and the fantasy of, say, for example, a Disneyland kind of park, which is a fantasy. You're going to have to base all the design on the nature of these creatures themselves. They are real. They are physically real. They are caught up in the arc of time and history. They are geopolitically real. They're socioeconomically real. And so the place where you go to see them and hear about wildlife conservation and the various crises facing it cannot be framed as a fantasy. It needs to be framed in this sort of documentary way. And that is going to require a different kind of research, different kind of architecture, different kind of placemaking, signage, architectural expression, who's involved, collaborations, negotiations, validations, in order for that place to be or seem as legitimate as the animals in it. And that is why the work led to such a rich network of association with wildlife conservation people, cultural representatives, et cetera, is because you're starting from the premise that the narrative of the place is going to require a kind of visual style that is harmonious with the narrative itself. And that visual style is not necessarily the idealized form that people would associate with a fantasy-based theme park.
Got it.
You see what I mean?
I do. So the medium is the message?
Kind of, yeah. It's
okay.
It's not real. It is no more real. Well, it's a little bit more real because there are real animals, right? But it's not more real than a fantasy-based place. It's a different kind of narrative. Exactly as the difference if I said to you, once upon a time, blah, 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 blah. You understand once I say once upon a time, you are ready for whatever story I'm going to tell you. But if I say Dateline Moscow, that's a different story. I've only said two words. And you know, that story is not like once upon a time, right? So you have
what if it's used that way?
Well, that's, I think, begins to drift into, I guess, propagandistic utilizations. All these principles are raw principles, right? They are just principles. Anyone can use them. So they can be used a lot of different ways. I think for the purposes in which we were engaged to use them, they're sort of proactive attempt. Basically, our idea was we want people to understand that animals are intimately connected to land and intimately connected to the actions of humans whose lives intersect them. It's not really a place just about animals. It's not expository in that way. This is a place for you to come away with the impression that animals are intimately connected both to land and to people. And therefore, your actions have impact. They're not great spaces for what people call pedagogical exposition. That's not why you're there, and it's not what you're prepared for, and it's not how you budget your time. Though that's for a book. Books can go into depth, and they can, you know how books work. These are places that when you open a book now have provided you with sensory experience that adds greater depth to what you might read in that book. Because you, instead of simply having an abstract, you have visual memory and you have sensory memory of a kind of simulacrum of what it might be to be in such a place, to be in a small, you know, town at the edge of a safari park, to be in a small village in Asia at the edge of open land where animals roam. What might that be like? So that you can bring more concrete visualization to data, that kind of thing.
I get it. And I this is something that's, as you can hear in what I'm telling you, so interested in. I want to mention that this is not just a shot in the dark. However, the Disney Conservation Fund has distributed over $125 million in grants worldwide. You know, and this started with this, what Joe is talking about with us today, dear listener, this philosophy of the connection between the wildlife and the land and the people, and how this is, you know, seared into the imagination of many, many millions of people who have seen the wild animal park, and so the Animal Kingdom theme park, and therefore the funds have been raised to this extent, $125 million.
Yeah, so it might be even a little more at this point. I don't check as often as I should because now I'm retired, so I don't track. But it's not by any means the biggest conservation fund in the world, but it's very respected and it's very well run. And most of that funding goes to field work. It does not go to administrative costs. It is very well designed and this is interesting because, again, you're dealing with a big organization, right? And so once you get them over the borderline of, look, it is essential that we have a conservation organization, all of the positive aspects, organizational experience, structural experience, leadership experience, networks, these all go into gear. Because they're like, okay, if we have to do this, how then do we do it well? Uh-huh. Right? It's really an interesting, it's like the switch turns over. The big challenge in the business in which I worked for so many years is getting people to choose to do something. Once they choose to do it, there's tremendous expertise in almost every field you could imagine to be leveraged to getting it done. The competition is in getting someone to choose to do the thing, right? Because there's so many choices you could make. There's so many things that could be done. And only so many of them can be done. And the moment a group of people choose to do it, they're locked up for 5 years doing it.
Yeah. I want to go to quick break. Joe, when you get back from the break, that's another one of the questions I had for you, which is, it's like, what did my father-in-law used to say? It's like a group experience, as you're talking about, is like putting a lot of cats into a pillowcase and shaking it. How, you know, the egos involved and the squirming involved and all the, you know, the, so I wanted to talk with you about how you corral a number of cats in a bag to do something like Disney's Animal Kingdom or the Forbidden Mountain and et cetera, some of the resorts that you've done. So I want to talk about that. It's such an interesting time in our history right now, where we're seeing all these massive egos collide in Washington. And I'm thinking about, how did you make that work in such a large corporation as Disney? Richard, let's go to quick break. When we get back from the break, I want to just quickly talk with Joe about how he corralled these egos. Yeah, don't turn that down. Back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I'm talking with Joe Rohde, and I apologize. I was pronouncing his name as Rohde. It's Rohde, and I should have known that. But at any rate, we asked Joe if he would opine on his method of corralling egos, having worked for, was it 44 years?
40.
At 40. In a huge, powerful corporation, and you're the creative one. Now, everybody and his brother thinks they're the creative one.
Well, people are creative. I mean, people are generally creative, or we'd all still be living on a tree branch somewhere. But when you're trying to do ensemble creativity, basically the method for organizing people, I've spoken a little bit about, is organizing, see if I can explain this. You have to work on the motive. You have to get people to cluster around, why are we doing this? What is our motive for doing it? And what this does, several things. Now, I use this term theme because it's a literary term. We're storytellers. In general, the things that we are building are narrative, and therefore this idea of theme is a useful term to gather people around. And I would tell people things like, look, imagine we were finished and there was one of those articles in the New Yorker magazine. There's like a 35-page long article where some reporter is going to analyze the thing that we built, and they're going to derive some theme from all the work and from how the team, and they're going to write this big long story about all of this stuff really means this. We're going to do that now. And then we're going to do the design. So the first thing we do is analysis. Just to stay on Animal Kingdom, for example, before any design takes place, we have long conversations about what do animals mean. When we say animal, what do we mean? Are we talking about cows? Is this going to be a cow place? Is this a pet dog place? Do we really mean that? What do we not mean when we say animal? We got to figure out what we mean. And what does it imply? Does animal imply freedom? If it does, then we're going to have to find a way to express that. Does animal imply innocence? What does it imply? And then this word kingdom, what does that mean in this case? It's not a political kingdom. Why are we even using that word? What does that mean? And out of that comes a little thesis, a little thing of like, look, if we're going to do a place about animals, it's not really pedagogical. It's about our relationship to animals. And our positive relationship to animals is some form of love. We either love them for their physical beauty, or we love them intellectually because they're so interesting, or we love them in our imagination because of things we think about them. So that's a thing that it's really about. It's a relationship thing. And then the value set of this place has to be derived from the freedom of these animals to be animals. And so it must be about the superior, immovable value of nature, that nature is a value deeper and richer than any value that could be held up against it. That has to be true in order for us to have the animals, in order for us to make a place where animals belong. And there's got to be something about the encounter, the nature of adventure, that adventure is not a physical bungee jump thing. Adventure is a psychological confrontation with that which you don't know, with the mysterious, with the new, because that's what it's going to be like to be in a place like this. So that must be true. And we can't have narratives that are closed because the animals live and die in the arc of time. So we can't really do those kind of stories with an ending. All the stories must be open-ended. And in order to be open-ended, they must be about you and what's happening to you, your choices, your ideas. This must be what it is. So out of that comes a kind of it's not exactly a mission statement. It doesn't say anything about what we're going to do other than whatever we're going to do is going to be like this. It's going to be like this. So when you process that with a group of people, and then you begin to run design case studies against it, it rapidly becomes astonishingly clear. Like, for example, and I could, you know, you would be able to answer this question as well as anybody else. If I have a place dedicated to expressing the intrinsic value of nature, and in that place is going to be a building, is that building more likely to be geometric and pristine, or is it more likely to seem organic and subject to the forces of nature? It's just more likely to be organic, irregular, and subject and patinaed and subject to the forces of nature. So once I have that building, just in my mind, right? It doesn't even exist yet. And then I can go, well, if there's a door in this building, and remember, Animal Kingdom's like 500 acres, it's huge, right? If there's a door, is that door steel or is it wood? Oh, it's probably wood. Is the wood smooth or is it rough? Oh, it's probably rough. If there's a doorknob, is it going to be shiny or rusty? Oh, I bet it's rusty. And so once you do this a few times, you've created such a strong sense of what it should be like that you can turn people loose for the most part, and they will generate ideas that are internally consistent with each other because they're all generating ideas according to this thesis of what it is meant to be like. So now what happens to the team dynamic is that instead of being based on ego-based competition, it's all based on critique. You can turn to any other person, including myself, as the nominal leader of the group and say, wait a minute, you said the intrinsic value of nature should manifest itself as this kind of, you know, heavily eroded, patina-y, kind of rumbly, tough-looking surface, and that is not that surface. That looks pretty smooth to me. Why is it that way, right? So that's called triadic negotiation, where two people are not talking about each other. They're talking about a third thing, and that third thing is objective, right? So if you can do this, over time, it becomes the habit of the team, and it diffuses the crisis of ownership.
Uh-huh.
Which is typically a creative problem.
Yep.
It helps people to collaborate.
I love it. I think that's brilliant. And obviously you've used it so many times. And my guess, We had just have to have a further conversation because we actually have to wrap up in a couple minutes. But Joe, when we meet again, I want to talk about this idea of, okay, so you've got the collaborative triangulation in the creative process, and it's leading towards a visualization of something that is in aid of a narrative structure. Where does that measure up to the historical accuracy of, say, that building?
Right.
You know, do you start with understanding just the concept of what maybe that would look like? I mean, this is a conversation for another
right.
time, but
yeah.
I have to tell you, it's been fascinating to listen to some of, and I can't wait to see the show at Community Arts Workshop.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I will be there. And let's do this again, Joe, please.
Sure.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.